ॐ ज्ञानतिमिरन्नस्याज्ञानञ्जनाशलाकाया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः
too, Mountain View. Don't you love it here?
Yes.
In this bookstore. It's amazing. So It's no accident we're all here together. Somehow we're in the same planet at the same time, and we've converged in this one place. Let's try an experiment to start with, shall we? Anyone who has the wherewithal to move up, please come up closer and fill in the spaces, and let's just see what happens when we do that. And I am vegetarian, so don't be afraid. Shraddha, you can move my coat off of there. Feel free to come all the way to the front. It's actually a different experience. I have a few handouts too, if you'd like. And first, tonight we'll begin with a prayer to invoke auspiciousness. So I'll say and then please repeat. Om Namo.
Om Namo
Bhagavate
Bhagavate
Vasudevaya
Vasudevaya.
So we're recognizing the supreme consciousness, which is all pervading within every atom of the universe. And to speak, to hear, to think, all comes from our divine source. Welcome.
Thank you.
Do you mind moving up a little closer?
Oh.
Please.
So we're going to record and take some photos. So if you have any objections, please let us know before we start. No? Okay. No.
Or if you have any objections to your face being in a picture of the video, you can sit in the back.
Well, if that's the case, don't take any pictures. I don't want anybody moving that. In fact, I'm going to move up a little closer, too, because it's better to be close. It's a real pleasure to meet all of you. My name is Vaisheshika Das. It's a name that I received when I got initiation from my spiritual master in 1973 here in San Francisco in the Bay Area. And I grew up in Lafayette, California, and when I was around 15 years old, I became an avid seeker. I had asked a lot of questions when I was a young kid about why I had to die, and no one really had an answer for that. And it became more clear to me that that was important, especially when I was in high school. I started thinking that, what's all this for? And I began a search, reading as much as I could and looking everywhere I could to find out what life really meant. After all, it is a little mysterious. We come into the world and it's a little abrupt. We pop out and someone slaps a name tag on us and says, this is your new name and here's your new place. And it's not really clear where we came from and it's not really clear where we're going. I mean, there's a lot of theories about it, but it's not apparent. And in many of the spiritual books that I read from around the world, I found good information, inspiring information from many teachers. But when I read the Bhagavad Gita, I found that there was a continuancy of all the knowledge convergence that worked for me very well. So I became an avid student of the Bhagavad Gita. And then I met a teacher from India, who was traveling all over the world and teaching the Bhagavad Gita. So that's how I got started on my spiritual path. And I lived in an ashram or in a monastery for 13 years, starting when I was 17 years old, and various places around the world. And I studied and did service. And then when I was around 30 years old, I got married, which was part of the progression in the tradition I come from, and have been married for 30 years now. And my wife is also a practitioner, and we've continued throughout our various adventures in life, starting businesses and things like that, to apply the principles of Bhagavad Gita. So I've had experience both on the side of renunciation and also utilizing the things of the world in the tradition or the the method, using the methodologies of Bhagavad Gita. So I'll quote a little bit from the Bhagavad Gita tonight. Are any of you familiar with that book, the Gita? Guy, you are. I met Guy when he first came in. And nice to meet you too. Where are you from?
Palo Alto.
Palo Alto. Fantastic city. Pleasure.
Thank you.
It's good to see you. Bhagavad Gita, you've heard of it?
Heard of it. I have
heard of it. Okay. Bhagavad Gita is from India. It's a book written in Sanskrit about 5,000 years ago, according to many scholars. There are many, many versions of the Gita. In fact, I just saw one out in the bookstore that's $1,000. It's about this big. It's beautifully illustrated. But it's a celebrated book. Thoreau, Emerson, Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Albert Einstein, the Beatles, they all read Bhagavad Gita. And it's a commonsensical kind of book. And it has information about yoga. So why don't you hand a few of these out? I'm going to follow this outline, and then you can take this home so you can remember any of the points I made. And also, I'll make a few points, and then I'll ask if you have any reflections. So reflection is a little different than a question. It just means anything that you hear that kind of sticks in your mind, you can reflect it back. And that way, it augments that particular point. Who's heard of the word yoga? Yes? So, in Sanskrit, it comes from a root word, which is yuj. And yuj means to join something together. And it's cognate with the modern English word yoke. You know, the yoke, like oxen are held together. So, throughout the Bhagavad Gita, we're receiving yoga wisdom, and that is really how to reconnect with our original source. And I've given this definition of yoga at the top of the page as a starting point for the context I'm going to be talking about some of the wisdom of the Gita from tonight. And also, as we mentioned in the advertisement for this class, that there are secrets from the Gita for uplifting the human spirit. That's not a bad idea, right? At any time. So, first of all, yoga is the systematic isolation of the conscious self, Atma, from matter. So, I just give a few definitions in these lines that help the context of what I'm going to talk about. So, systematic isolation of the conscious self, which is called in Sanskrit, Atma. Can everyone say Atma, please?
Atma.
So, sometimes in Christian theology, the word is used soul, sometimes in Sanskrit, and the Bhagavad Gita is called Atma. So the Atma is the self. So when speaking in the context of the Bhagavad Gita, the Atman, or the Atma, the self, is considered to be categorically different from the body. The body is more or less described, not more or less, exactly described as a machine. So we might say it is a biological robot. In Sanskrit, it's called a yantra. I mean, if you look at it carefully, you see it has levers and pulleys and a whole system of transporting liquid through it and everything like that. It's decidedly a machine, a yantra. And its biological nature, very complicated. And what makes it run? Biofuel. Did you have any biofuel fuel today? Any of you? Yes. So, what is considered to be knowledge in the Bhagavad Gita, fundamental knowledge, is an understanding of the difference between this machine and the Atma, the self. And to repeat, the energy of the Atma is categorically different from the energy of the body. And this is something that in the speaker of the Bhagavad Gita, the main teacher in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna, speaks to his disciple Arjuna. And the context of the Bhagavad Gita is on a battlefield. Arjuna is a great warrior, the greatest martial artist of the time. And they're going into this battle, and Arjuna uncharacteristically loses his nerve going into the battle. And his chariot driver then becomes his teacher, because Arjuna's saying, why are we fighting this war? What's going to happen? And Krishna begins to teach him the knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita, which is actually a consolidation of what's in the ancient texts of India called the Upanishads. So the basic premise is that there's a difference between the body and the Atma, and the body is made up of elements that are named in the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit, Bhumir Apo Analo Vayu Kam Mano Budir Evacha Ahankara Ityame Bhina Prakritir Ashtada. That's earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and ego. So these are called the gross and subtle elements. And then Krishna says, besides these, there's a superior energy. And that energy is the energy of the Atma, which it doesn't undergo entropy. It doesn't diminish at any time. It can't be separated. It can't be cut, burned, dried, and so forth, like the material body can. The material body can be dissembled at any time. And if it isn't abruptly done, it does so gradually, as I can attest to, as you get older, as one gets older. So, yoga, the systematic isolation of the conscious self from matter, there's a process. And that is one of the subject matters of the Bhagavad Gita. So a couple more points. Welcome. Thank you for coming. A couple more points listed up. Just, we're on this second line coming from the top, where it says, you have free will. And I put the dictionary definition of free will, the power of acting without the constraint of necessity or fate. So this is a basic premise also that it's important to remember when I'm talking about some of the principles tonight, free will. And the next one is that you're an agent. What do I mean by that? An agent is a person who takes an active role or produces a specified effect. So, if I don't have free will and I'm not an agent, in other words, if I can't change things, what's the point of talking about these things? And why are there so many instructions given in books like Bhagavad Gita if I can't take them up? So these two points I thought I'd make at the outset, just to give the basic premise. Okay, so you see the picture there in the middle of the page, and what do you suppose that is? Can you make it out? What is your name?
Anisia.
Anisia, what do you think that is?
Orchids, I'm not too sure. Or cherry blossoms.
It is cherry blossoms. It's actually a tree, and it's on a lake, and it's reflecting itself on the lake. I was in North Carolina recently, and friends of mine took me to this park. Do you know the name of the park? I don't know. That's why I'm asking. She's from North Carolina. We went walking around and said, you're going to see a reflecting pool. And I'd heard of them. And but when I saw this, I was mesmerized, because I was standing watching, and I honestly could not distinguish the difference between the reflection and the tree. And it looked just like this. This may actually be the picture of that place. But that's what this is. It's a blossoming tree that's on a lake, and it's being reflected onto the lake. Why is this relevant to Bhagavad Gita? In the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna teaches about the nature of the material world that we live in. And he says it's very much like a reflection, or it is a reflection, precisely a reflection. It's a reflection of reality. It's not reality itself. And that's why I put matter versus consciousness equals reflection versus reality. So matter that we're ensconced in, that I'm encased in, the Atma is within, is a temporary energy. It's always moving, it's always changing, whereas the Atma is the same. And you'll notice the verse from the Bhagavad Gita right under the picture, if we can read it together. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the Atma, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. So this verse in Sanskrit, nasato vidite bhavo, napavo vidite sita, ubayor api drishnon tas tvanayos tatvadarshibi. It ends with tatvadarshibi. It means those who, darshibi means seers, those who can see things as they are. And what do they see? Tatva. So this word is interesting in Sanskrit. Tatva means to see that which actually exists. And what's the opposite of that? What's being described here is matter. Matter is, because it's temporary, it's not given the full status of existence. It's constantly changing and morphing, whereas tat, and therefore you get the word tatva, is that which is permanent. And so this is a basic premise of the Bhagavad Gita, that the material body that we're living in is made up of the changing elements of the material world, whereas the Atma is the same. And this is an important analyzation that takes place, as we'll see when I move to the next point, which is what is called in the Vedas, a vast body of knowledge that describes how to achieve complete state of happiness in life. That one may become overwhelmed, when I say one, an Atma, that's who we are, may become overwhelmed by this material energy. And there's a state of consciousness called weakness of heart. So the definition of that is an irrational attachment to the reflection. So if there's a tree, and then there's a reflection, perhaps there's a fruit on the tree, and you see the fruit in the reflection, can you take that fruit? What do you think? What is your name?
Arvind.
Arvind, yeah. You can't take it, right? But, and if it's a good reflection, it looks exactly like the real fruit, but you never actually get it. So this is a bit of a dilemma, and this is a point that Krishna brings up in the Bhagavad Gita, that as I'm moving about the world, observing the various items of enjoyment in this world, and I try to take them, I never quite get them. Because it's a reflection. I never quite get there. In Sanskrit, there's a word for mirage, which is a similar concept. Anybody here seen a mirage? Where did you see it, Guy?
In the valley.
In the valley. What does it look like?
It's filled with water where I was.
It looks like water, right? I saw one in Death Valley. My parents used to take us out camping and things like that. We drive across Death Valley. My brother and I sitting in the back seat of the car. We say, there's a lake. And they say, there's no lake there. And we say, no, no, we see the lake, it's right there. And they say, no, that's not a lake, that's something else. And we were vehemently arguing with our parents that no, there's water there. But after half an hour of not getting there and still seeing the lake, we began to understand the wisdom behind their statement that there isn't actually water there, it's just a reflection of water. So the what irrational means, that although I never quite get there, although I'm never actually able to embrace the things that I want because, and I'll go into that in just a second, because they're temporary, I still remain attached to them. So that's the definition in the Vedas of what is called dorabalyam, tridaya dorabalyam, which means a weakness of heart. So this next section is about overcoming weakness of heart, which is one of the keys to happiness, according to the Bhagavad Gita. So, first of all, there's a rational approach, and that's kind of what we've been talking about now, something philosophical, looking at the world in a different way. So one of the ways in which the Bhagavad Gita describes how to achieve a state of happiness and overcome weakness of heart is to deliberate. Mm-hmm. And the word deliberate has a few different connotations. One is that you've given thorough consideration. Another is that you're aware of consequences. And a third is that you take your time before you make a decision about something. So this deliberation is a part of the process given in the Bhagavad Gita to actually take a minute to consider what is my situation in this world. Without knowledge, if I simply move forward and I don't have a clear map and I don't have a clear idea, I may become overwhelmed by the circumstances. So the next verse from the Bhagavad Gita, you'll see under the deliberate, if we can read together, an intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery which are due to contact with the material senses. O son of Kunti, such pleasures have a beginning and an end, and so the wise person does not delight in them. So this is a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, and in the Sanskrit it says, Yehi samsparshaja poga dukha yonaya evate. That's the first half of the verse, and I'll just point out a couple of words in that that are interesting. Samsparsha means to make physical contact, the senses making physical contact with their objects in the world. And so this is called a sparsha. Yehi samsparsha bhoga. And bhoga means to try to enjoy. So to try to enjoy the contact of the senses and their objects. Dukha yonaya evate. So yonaya comes from the word yoni, which means a womb. So there's this metaphor being given here that what is born from that contact between my physical senses and their objects, duk, which means misery. That sounds kind of extreme, but let's break it down a little bit. There's another very famous book about yoga called the Yoga Sutras. It's written by Patanjali Rishi. And this is a book which teaches that all happiness and all misery are born in the mind. They come from the mind. We live in the small worlds of our minds in material consciousness, and we suffer because of our state of consciousness. And he says that there are two reasons why my contact of my senses with the objects of the world causes misery. So the first one he calls tapa, and that means that we have an intuitive sense that whatever I get in this world will eventually diminish. And that is a premise of this verse where Krishna says, Adyantavanta Kaunteya, he says, the things that you try to contact in this world, that you become attached to, have a beginning and an end. And therefore, he says, an intelligent person, a wise person, doesn't become overly attached to them. And in the same way, Patanjali Rishi says that there's a kind of anxiety that one has when trying to embrace the things of this world, because as soon as I get them, I know that I have a sense I'm going to lose them, right? I had a friend in high school. He was always talking about how he wanted to buy this really expensive car. I think it was a Porsche. And I saw him years later, and I said, did you ever get that car? And he said, yeah, I got it. And I said, how was it? And he said, well, I can tell you the time I enjoyed it the most was the night before I bought it. Because then after that, The next thing I was thinking, where to park it so nobody would scratch it. I was warned that somebody might try to steal it. And it became, although it was sort of a status symbol in his mind, still there was a lot of anxiety around it. And any of the ways in which, even the best circumstances in this world that I embrace, there's a deep-seated anxiety that it's going to go away. And I may stuff that anxiety, but still it's there. It's all pervading because of the dichotomy between myself and matter. So this is what Krishna's talking about in this verse. So he says, and then the second thing, interesting point that Patanjali makes about trying to enjoy the world is that it's called samskar. Can everyone say samskar?
Samskar.
Samskar means that when I take material pleasure, then it leaves an impression in my mind. It becomes embedded in my mind. And even if I decide not to do it again, the impression is still there, and there's a craving that comes up. In fact, it can become so deep that even my intelligence says, this is not good for me. Don't do it ever again. The craving will come back and will say, no, you have to do it again. That sense object will become irresistible. Does that sound familiar at all? Has that ever happened? Take that as a yes. I mean, addiction, it comes to a point where there's absolute positive proof this is not good, the intelligence agrees and everything, but I just can't stop doing it. So samskar means that I develop these propensities for enjoying items in the world that ultimately cause me to be entrapped. So what is my relationship ultimately with matter? I said that this, according to the Bhagavad Gita, the Atma is categorically different from matter. So how is it that I'm involved in the world at all? Well, let's take another example of a car. Did anybody drive here tonight? What is your name?
John.
John. Let's just say, John, your car is right outside here. Is that fair enough? Okay, and John's car is out there. Anybody else drive? You drove, okay. So we hear somebody come careening down the alleyway, right where we know you parked your car, you know you parked your car, and you hear a smashing noise. And then you can triangulate and sort of figure out that, yeah, that was probably my car. So how do you feel now?
Really upset.
Upset, and then there might even be physical symptoms. Your heart might, you know, speed up, maybe a little perspiration. Then you run to that door and you look out, and turns out it's not your car. Somebody else's car. Now how do you feel?
Relieved.
A lot different, right? Yeah, so one thing is that a car is just a car. I mean, they're made out of metal, and they're glass and rubber and things like that. But there's a big difference between a car and my car. And so this is the way in which I become connected to the world. It's called, in the Bhagavad Gita, Sangha, Asa-Anga. So my arm is an Anga of my body. It's a limb. So the things of this world are just things, actually. Things are things are things. But when I extend myself into them, I actually project my consciousness into matter. And then I say, that's mine. So there's a difference between a car and my car. And the difference is it's a problem for me now because I'm connected to it. How am I actually connected to it? I'm not really connected to it. The Vedic wisdom says, asango kyayam purushaha. Actually, the Atma has no real connection to anything in the material world. It's almost as if when one's in a dream, and as an example, say, a tiger's chasing me. And I'm lying on the couch and I'm rolling back and forth saying, tiger, tiger. And I begin to perspire and so forth. But somebody else watching me is thinking, no tiger, everything's okay. So there's this projection that I make, and this is being presented in this verse, this idea that I become attached to matter and the things irrationally. So one of the first stages in yoga is to rationally and intellectually analyze the world, look at it and see where the different elements and what my relationship is to them actually. So that's the rational approach, and that's just a little basic background, the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita relating to the difference between matter and the Atma. And now I'll just take a few reflections. And that means any one thing that you heard that stuck in your mind. Yes?
So like it says here that we're agents who have an active role, but I've also heard the teaching that we're not the doers, that the gunas act through us. So like how do you reconcile both of those statements?
Well, when the Bhagavad Gita and other yogic texts talk about how only the gunas are acting, they're saying that as from a specific perspective. Just like if someone picks up an axe to cut some wood, say that actually the axe is working. And there are five factors to action that Krishna mentions in the Bhagavad Gita. One of them is the will of the Atma, and the other elements are things that are beyond the control of the Atma. So it's not that we don't have free will, and the argument which is given in the Vedanta Sutra, which is a consolidation of the Vedic teachings, is that if the Atma was not an agent for change, then why are there so many instructions given throughout the Vedic wisdom? If there's nothing you can do about it, then it's senseless. There's no need to take any kind of instruction at all. So the Atma, we, can take action if we take proper wisdom and we methodically carry it out. Then that's the theme of the Bhagavad Gita. One can actually improve oneself and rise above the influence of the gunas. It's one of the themes of the Gita. What else did you hear? Any one thing that you heard that stuck?
If there are no cravings, how do we progress? How do we move forward? Because it's these cravings that we put our will into creating and moving forward. So
yeah, so that's a good point. I gave a talk at Google last night, and that same question came up. And so Bhagavad Gita doesn't teach that we become non-entities, or that by giving up our connection to irrational cravings, that we don't have any cravings, or that we become non-creative, or that we don't move. But the description I'll give with an analogy of a number line. On a number line, you have your negative numbers, and let's just say we're at -8 right now. The idea of interacting with matter, which I think everyone can relate to that. The United States has been going pretty strongly for a couple hundred years, and we've racked up a little bit of a debt here, national debt. And personally, it's easy to rack up debts. And this is the idea of karma. It means that I enjoy the world, I go into the world of the cravings, and I interact with matter, and then I have to pay for it later. So just like spending on a credit card, I can live very nicely for a while, but then I have to pay for it later. So that's the world of the negative numbers on the number line. So then oftentimes we find philosophies which make a lot of sense, which say move out of the negative numbers, and you keep moving up the number line, so you're at 7, -6, -5, 4, 3, 2, Where am I heading?
Positive.
Zero.
I'm heading first to zero. So coming to zero means that, and there is a case for this, which is called moksha in the Bhagavad Gita and other literatures, which means kind of a liberation from the experience of having this crushing debt called karma in the material world. And when I get to zero, there's a huge relief because I'm no longer being compelled to move. You've seen the bumper sticker maybe, I owe, so it's off to work I go. So that's the idea, why am I moving in this world? It's because I have a debt to pay. And the other idea is, in the material world, it's a world of the realm of consciousness of exploitation. In order to actually live, even if you're a vegan, a vegetarian, whatever, you still have to eat plants. It's called jivo jiva sajivanam. One living entity is food for another. In order for me to expand my influence, I have to push other living entities out of the way. Even if I'm deliberately non-violent throughout my life, it's still that this is the realm we live in, the negative numbers. So when you come to zero, there's a huge relief. And that's the idea of liberation. But zero means no activity. Where do I go from there? And the Bhagavad Gita says, you can't stay there. It's like if you work for a company and you don't like the terms, you go on strike. So it's kind of an interim situation. We say, we don't like this, and we're not working. But you got to go back to work somewhere. But as you were just about to say, going into the positive numbers. This is the idea of the Bhagavad Gita, that you move for a different reason. I'm not moving for exploitation, I'm moving for service. It's a different consciousness, and it's a different purpose in life. And all the same central experiences there, the interaction with the world, but because I'm moving for a different reason, my intention is different, it transforms the environment in a meaningful way. And this is what Krishna calls in the Bhagavad Gita the art of yoga. This is the art of living life without becoming entangled. And he gives this example of a lotus. How many of you have ever seen a live lotus flower? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. In Osaka, Japan, where I frequent, and during the summertime, there's a botanical garden that I like to go to. And they have an array of lotus flowers that bloom during the summer months. And they're extraordinarily beautiful. You can sit there and just look at them for a long time. And the example Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita of a lotus is that a lotus grows out of the mud. In fact, it's called Padmaja, that which is born out of mud. And it grows up through the water. And if you take a close look at a lotus flower and its leaves, although it's in the water, because of its constitution, it never actually touches the water. Where the water is so isolated from the leaves and the plant, it simply rolls off, so it's not affected, in other words. So in a similar way, Krishna says, a person who learns the art of reforming consciousness can live in the world without being touched by it. And so one is active, one is creative, everything, all the cravings, it's different kind of cravings. They're actually spiritual cravings. And it's not an irrational connection to matter, which is, I say irrational because this is what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that it's irrational to be connected to something that won't last.
Your husband, your dear friends.
It's important, and this is also the art of yoga, to know how to interact with the world in a responsible way, but at the same time have one's consciousness connected to a higher position. So these two things are mentioned, paramartika and vyavaharika. So vyavaharika means to live in the world in a balanced way. That's also part of yoga. For instance, if I go for a job interview And they ask me, where are you from? And say, well, I'm actually not from this world. I'm spiritual. And they'll say, okay, next, you know, get out of here. You have to be practical, according to the Bhagavad Gita, to actually live in the world. And family members and, you know, society seen in actual perspective, there's even a deeper appreciation when one has this vision that these are individual spiritual beings that I'm taking care of. There's a higher purpose for taking care of them than they're just my family or just my nation or something like that. And that's the Paramartika vision, understanding there's an ultimate purpose to life besides just maintaining the status quo in this world. There's a lot more to say on that. One more reflection, one thing that you heard so far. Could just be a phrase or a word or a thought.
I like the effect you use irrational to the rational to the world.
Yeah.
It's interesting that they're calling it irrational.
Yeah, I like that phraseology, irrational attachment. In fact, in Sanskrit, there's a term called asat trishna. So trishna means thirst, and asat means that which won't last. So this is what the Vedic conception is of irrational attachment. Don't get so thirsty for something that's not going to quench your thirst. It's not really there. It won't do the job. So it's irrational. Find where the real water is. That's the point.
I know one.
Yes.
It's interesting starting with talking about the Atma, and then you explain that Atma is an agent. And that is, as an agent to understanding the Atma without beyond this body and this mental activities, and to realizing that unseen Atma. I think that is a job for as an agent.
Mm. Yeah. This is actually a premise of any self-respecting self-help book that you'll find, is that we're not victims. We are actually agents. You can actually improve through knowledge and practice. So it's an important premise. Thank you. Next is a practical approach Bhagavad Gita gives. So first I talked about rational approach, intellectual approach, and then at the bottom of the page, rational approach. So what I like to call voluntary life changes. These are called the VLCs. And so the first one is change the subject, change your fortune. Could everyone repeat that?
Change the subject, change your fortune.
So the idea is that as Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita, there are higher and lower energies. And he also mentions that there's spiritual sound, there's transcendental sound, and there's material sound. And they have a different effect on us. And the type of sound vibration that I subject myself to determines my consciousness, and my consciousness then determines my activities. And my activities then, of course, determine my fortune. So there are many different kinds of topics that we might come in contact with in this world. And some of them that relate to the, as we say, the closed system of the material world are considered to be material. And those that are from beyond the closed system of the material world are called transcendental, and they have a different effect. In another book, in an Upanishadic book, the Shriyash Upanishad, Anyad Ebahur Sambhavad, Anyad Ahura Sambhavad, Iti Shushuma Dhiranam, Inas Tadvich Chakshire, which means that one effect is obtained by coming in contact with spiritual sound, and a completely different effect comes about by coming in contact with material sound. So, as an example, if one were to, for instance, involve oneself in listening to the 24-hour news cycle for maybe 24 hours, how do you think you'd feel? So that's a serious question. I was wondering how you might feel.
Huh? 24-hour news basically meets you into this news world and mysteries.
Restless.
You know, you feel restless?
Zombie.
Depressed. Like a zombie, huh?
Depressed.
Depressed. Yeah, you know, one might experiment with this. I saw someone made a documentary, went around just ate fast food for a month and he almost died or something. And similarly, if one subjects oneself to a fragmentary information that is specifically designed to agitate the mind. I'm just picking on the news cycle right now because it's just so easy to pick on. I mean, when I was young, there was only one news channel, Huntley Brinkley, and nowadays there's hundreds of them. And there's lots of information flowing into our lives all the time. I don't know whose idea it was to put a television set in a taxi cab. I take taxis all the time because I have to go to the airport to fly out places. But you jump in and there's a television. And then if you go in many grocery stores now, they can put up a television. So when you're waiting in line, who thought of that? Whose idea was that one? But the information flows out. And what is the quality of it? And what is the effect? This is an important question to ask. It's practical. So there, according to Bhagavad Gita, and the Upanishads and the other Vedic wisdom texts, there are other sounds that actually elevate the human spirit. And many of these come in the form of mantra. Have you heard the word mantra before? Mantra? Have you experimented with mantra or have interaction with mantra? It's become sort of the word also people use, any phrase that's repeated over and over again nowadays. But the origin of the word in Sanskrit, man means mind. And tra comes from the word triyate, which means to deliver. So it's a sound vibration that delivers the mind from anxiety and from irrational attachment to the material world. It actually has some potency behind it. So when I speak the mantra, and I listen to it, I ingest that sound, so to speak, through my ears, it actually has a systemic effect on my my body, my mind, and my spirit, and it's uplifting. And one can experience it for oneself. In fact, one of the great yoga texts, the Srimad Bhagavatam, says that you should try it for yourself to see. Suspend disbelief and then try it. And says that it's like eating food when you're hungry. When you're famished and you eat, you notice for yourself that you become nourished, that you become satisfied, and your hunger goes away. And no one needs to give you a certificate. You know for yourself directly, right? So in a similar way, with spiritual sound, one experiences for oneself that there is a natural way in which one's spiritual perception of the world is elevated. And also, there's what is called virakti, or detachment, which means a natural detachment from interaction with the material world in an irrational way that we spoke about before. It's called virakti. So this is one of the prescriptions in the Vedic texts called mantra meditation. So the various different kinds of meditation. And mantra meditation is specifically powerful because in meditation one needs a place to fix one's mind. And the idea, of course, given by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutra is that the mind is like the surface of a lake. And there are many impressions which are like winds that are disturbing that lake. and therefore we can't see clearly. So the attempt then is to calm that surface so that one can actually see clearly below the surface. One is able to deeply introspect. By deeply introspecting, there's a profound experience, according to the Gita and the other yoga texts, of happiness. And why is it happiness? Because that's our nature. It's not that one has to become something else, which is a conception in the mind, when mind is in connection with matter, that in order to be satisfied, I need something else. I need to go somewhere else. I need to get one more thing, or many more things, in order to be satisfied. And there's an example given in the Vedas about the musk deer, who emanates from the gland in its navel the most heavenly smell called musk. And the musk deer is mythologically said to then spend its whole life trying to find the origin of that beautiful scent, going up large mountains and into caves and searching everywhere to find where is this scent coming from, not knowing all the time that it actually emanates from its own navel. So in a similar way, the Vedas say, what you're looking for everywhere else, externally, is actually within you. So meditation is meant to actually discover that thing which is already there, and one has an experience then that I don't need to go anywhere, I don't need to become something else, I already am something that's so remarkable that just by even momentarily experiencing it, I feel a kind of fulfillment that I can't get anywhere else. So the mantra meditation is specifically powerful because just as a particular drug has a potency, similarly, each mantra has a particular potency to it. So when one utilizes the mantra for one's point of concentration, not only does it help one fix one's mind, but the mantra also adds potency to the process. And one can feel the potency of the mantra just as you would feel the systemic effect of medicine when you take medicine as well. Do you believe that? Say yes.
Yes.
So mantra meditation is highly recommended and easily available because as one of the great teachers of mantra meditation used to say, that you don't require any extra paraphernalia. It's all there. You just need a tongue. You can use your tongue. Check and see if it's still there. And then the ears, which are actually really interesting. If you take a few minutes when you go home as homework and look in the mirror, just look at your ears for a while, you'll start thinking, well, those are really weird. But they're like satellite dishes. They actually, they catch sound really nicely. And I was walking in my neighborhood in Burlingame a few years ago, and I'm always looking around the world for things to write about, as I write. And I just noticed on each one of the storm drains, there's a little placard, and it says, "No dumping drains to bay." Have you ever seen those?
Yes.
Because anything you put into the ecosystem, it runs down water seeks in level, it ends up in San Francisco Bay. And there's a lot of stuff down there. Tests have been done of the water, and it is quite polluted. So, in a similar way, I was considering I should have a little placard above my ears that says "No dumping drains to bay," because the heart is like it's the bay of the heart. Whatever I put in here, it ends up going into my heart, and it stays there for a long period of time. So, if I put toxic things in my ear, they end up haunting me. I can attest to that. I watched television when I was a kid, and I can still remember many of the jingles from the commercials. Would you like me to sing you a few? No. but it's impressive how long-lasting these things are. So, this is a practical matter that if one changes the subject changes the environment that one lives in as far as the sound vibration goes, then one's consciousness immediately and drastically improves. This is one of the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. And it's, anyone can do this. It just adjusts. Even Dr. Andrew Weil, who is a allopathic and naturopathic doctor, had recommends to his patients frequently that take a 30-day news fast. That's why I brought up the news cycle. Just don't listen to news for 30 days and see if you notice a difference. Just on the prohibitive side, just try that. And I can attest an experiment in that. And my realization was that any news that actually is important enough for me to know reaches a certain threshold that I'll hear it on the street and I'll say, guess what happened? And the rest is not so important, which agitates the mind. So that's a practical matter in yoga, is changing what you're listening to and introducing transcendental sound through mantra meditation. So the next item that yoga wisdom gives is changing your attitude. So there's a large competition going on for being the controller or being the master, being the center. And there's a huge opportunity, which doesn't have a lot of competition, for being a selfless servant. If one thinks of how to do selfless service, how to do the highest good for as many people as possible, and makes that change in attitude, then very quickly one finds full employment everywhere one goes. And not only that, everyone's happy to see a person like that. So service attitude is very important. And the next very practical point in attitude is a mantra that I heard once in an interview, and I picked it up and found that it works very well. And that is, I'll say it, if you dare, please repeat it. I live to be corrected.
I live to be corrected.
And this is in one of the great yogic texts, the Srimad Bhagavatam, the quintessential attitude of a transcendentalist is taking everything that happens and seeing it as an opportunity for improving oneself rather than taking it as I'm being victimized. And sort of like compost, you know, every scrap, everything that looks like it could be thrown out or something like that can actually be composted and become fertilizer, become nourishment for the rest of my life. So looking at circumstances and utilizing this mantra, I live to be corrected. And then another one, as far as attitude goes, is I forgive you. And this one works really well, especially when you're driving. And there's something about being on the road. There's an impersonal nature to the car, because I don't know who's in the other one. I just see it as a large, imposing kind of beast that is, you know, could, you know, interrupt my life, even end it. And so, I mean, I've experimented when I'm on the road that, you know, say if someone does something that's not so favorable, and has anybody ever had this happen before, by the way? Yeah? So, you know, I hate it when people don't put on their turn signal. That's one thing. Because I always turn on my, but maybe I forgot once, I don't know. But different things. And then I turn my consciousness to think about how, well, what if the person who just cut me off or did something I didn't like, and I looked in the car and it was my mother. Would I say that? Or my best friend. Immediately my consciousness would change. And I started realizing that it's irrational on the road or anywhere else to hold on to these kinds of responses that come up from the mental system very easily. And So this mantra that I forgive you. So oftentimes driving, someone will do something foolish or rude or something like that. I'll just teach you this, how to do this mantra. You just go like this. I forgive you. It's amazing how it's just a change in attitude. And immediately, you know, you can release it. And keeping that is a practical way to not become entangled in the world. There's a little thing called a grudge. Has anybody heard of a grudge before? You know what it is? It's a little animal. It's a very fierce little animal that you can hold under your arm and carry around. He snarls at everybody. Very ugly little animal, a grudge. And, you know, people carry him around for a long time. What do you think the world record is for carrying a grudge? Huh? Lifetime, yeah. I mean, I know someone who carried a grudge for 20 years, carried it just like that. And people can carry it for a lifetime. And so this is one of the ways in which to live in the world without becoming overwhelmed by the material energy is don't carry grudges. Let them go. And this is only possible through knowledge and practice, living clean. And then change your habits. So here's one I talked about last night that was immediately people resonated with, which is to simplify. Because this is one of the principles taught in one of the famous yoga books called the Upadeshamrita, or the Nectar of Instruction. And it starts with Atyahara. It says, don't eat more than you need, and don't collect more than you need, because it weighs you down in the process of expanding your consciousness. So, simplifying. I took a couple approaches here. One is to organize the way that you approach your life, and that is decide what you want and write it down. There's a way in which someone could go through their whole life aimlessly without a map. And there's a possibility of just getting caught in a lot of different bad habits and ruts. But if you deliberately, as I mentioned earlier, by deliberating, you can become deliberate. If you deliberately write down what your aims are, what your goals are, and so forth, and prioritize them, then it makes for a simpler life, because and a more energetic life, because you know what you're aiming for. So prioritizing and then working from a list. And then I've given this these two circles from Stephen Covey, from his famous book, Seven Habits of Highly Successful People. And you see there in the middle, the circle of influence, and outside the circle of concern. This is such a powerful little diagram. It's so simple, isn't it? But it's very powerful, because just by looking at it, you can become relieved from mental anxiety. So, inside there's this circle of influence. It's very small. And then there's the circle of concern. Any of you have any concerns in life, by the way? Just start listing them. And they can expand unlimitedly. And if one simply looks at this circle and then considers, where does that concern fall? Does it fall within my realm of influence? Can I actually do anything about it? And if the answer is no, then you're too far outside. You've gone into a realm where you can't do anything for that circumstance. So come back into your circle of influence. And in yoga, specifically, the idea is that one should work on oneself very diligently, reform one's own consciousness. As the saying goes, become the change that you want to be in the world. Those who actually develop compassion, they develop detachment, they develop sense control, become very useful in helping other people, doing selfless service. Whereas if I'm overwhelmed by my own cravings and holding on to grudges and I'm weighed down and so forth, it's very difficult to show compassion and to do selfless service in the world. And externally, keeping only the things one needs. This is also part of Atyahara. Don't overcollect. It's easy to do, to collect more and more things, but as one professional organizer once told me, these extra things that I keep in my life amount to visual noise. And I don't even notice it after a while. It's just making a lot of noise and it disturbs my consciousness. But having a place for everything and putting everything in its place and keeping one's environment very simple helps to focus the mind, gives an environment in which one can focus one's mind and actually introspect. And it's just such a nice exercise to purge one's life of things that one doesn't need. And interestingly, this is part of the yoga process. How you live externally really makes a difference. And finally, take time each day to get a higher taste. Obviously a typo there. Higher taste. And here's a nice verse from the Bhagavad Gita. If you'd like, you can read it together. One whose happiness is within, who is active and rejoices within, and whose aim is inward, is actually the perfect mystic. He is liberated and supreme, and ultimately he attains the supreme. So this comes from the chapter 5 of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna is advocating this introspection. Find happiness within your own self. And there, in this outline, I've talked a little bit about the philosophy of observing the world and seeing the difference between matter and spirit, and the philosophy of practical activity to organize one's life around the principle of hearing spiritual sound, keeping one's life simplified. And what else did I say? Tell me three more points. What?
Change your attitude.
Yeah, adjust your attitude. That's something that we have control over. And if you change your attitude, then you change your whole reality, because as the saying goes, you don't see the world the way it is, you see the world the way you are. And that is something that's completely adjustable, because you have free will. You can change your attitude. You're an agent. What else?
Sound vibration.
Sound vibration. According to the Vedic teachings, this is the most essential part of life. If you just do this one thing, you change the channel, the things that you're listening to, and you take in a sound that is nourishing, then it will transform your life from the inside out. And no dumping, because it drains into the bay of your heart. And then later on, I may wonder, why am I in anxiety? Why am I in the situation I'm in now? It's because of what I've taken in here. This is what the Vedas say. They say that it all begins with sound, and what kind of sound you allow yourself to take in. So be selective, and get a diet of, find out what is spiritual sound. And experiment with it, take it in and see what it does for you. And you know, you can actually tune out sounds that are disturbing. We're not obligated to take them in. What are the things?
Circles of influence.
What?
Circles of influence and concern.
Yeah, why'd you mention that?
Because it's outside the circle of influence, whatever is there, it basically causes worry. Everything that.
Yeah, but why did you remember that particular one?
Because this is a very practical Venn diagram. Whenever a stressful situation comes up and we're worrying, instead of worrying and getting lost in that, we can determine logically what is in my influence right now. If at all this
so you find it useful?
Very useful.
Good. Yeah. What else?
Keep the things you need.
Yeah? Keep the things you need. Why'd you bring that up? Why did that resonate?
I have a tendency to hang on to too many things, and so, you know, when you're talking about the visual clutter, or just like the clutter, even digital clutter, like, there's so much stuff, I just, I don't want to let go.
It's hard too, because there's a lot of, we talked about this last night. There was actually another class after the Google class, and a lot of people were talking about how the reasons that they have for keeping things. Though, I'm going to fix it later. It was you. I can fix this. And, I can use it later. Maybe someone will want it or something like that. It's not easy to disentangle oneself from all the things in the world. And you know, as I brought up in the very first section, the systematic isolation of the conscious self from matter, just doing that brings peace of mind. It's a very practical thing, because things are, they can smother us, actually. And it's not that we just give away all things and we don't interact with things. This is not the philosophy, and I'm glad you brought that up earlier. The fact is that if one's utilizing things for a higher purpose, then all things can be transformed into something good. The example that's given in the Bhagavad Gita, Brahmarpanam Brahmahavir, etc. I won't give the whole verse, but in it he says that material things can become transformed if they're used for a higher purpose. They actually become spiritual. And an example my spiritual master used to give is, if you take an iron rod and you put it into fire and you leave it there for a long time, like with at a blacksmith, it changes from being an iron bar and it turns into fire because of contact. And in a similar way, that the lower energy of the material world, when utilized for a higher purpose, is transformed into something spiritual, something good. So it's utilitarian. Yeah, thank you for that. What else?
Habits.
Yeah, habits. Yeah. Habits are, habits can be deliberately changed with knowledge and practice. What other thing?
Grudges, holding on to grudges.
Yeah, don't hold on to grudges.
The example you give of must be
a... Yeah. Why did you like that?
Like, everything is within, whatever we are searching outside, everything is within us. We no need to find everything outside.
Yeah. There's a similar example given by the Upanishads, where they say that there's a destitute man sitting by the side of the road, and a well-wisher walks by and sees him and starts up a conversation, is inquiring how he's become destitute. And the man's telling how he doesn't have any prospect in life and how he's lost. And then the well-wisher notices that he's wearing something around his neck, and he says, "What is that?" And he brings his attention to it, and it turns out that it's a invaluable gem that he inherited from his family, and he's been wearing it all this time. He just forgot that it was there. And when he brings it out, he said, "Oh, now I remember, actually I'm wealthy." And so the transformation can take place very quickly. In fact, just by a little bit of introspection and the volume of the external world can immediately become quelled, and one can experience something internally that is so valuable. Yeah. Two more.
Changing the attitude, the "I forgive you" is more powerful than anything else.
Yeah.
Especially the driving things. We are all driving in our life. Our driving this life. So there is a lot of shifting and changing and turbulence, and everything is happening without further information. So it is always important to forgive whoever come in contact with you and making that turbulence.
Yeah. Yeah, very important for not becoming entangled unnecessarily.
Yeah. Instead of feeling victimized in difficult situations, you can actually learn some things and become better, become professional.
Yes. Yeah. You mean like by knowledge and practice?
By that situation, how you accept.
Oh, I see. Learning from the situation.
As a victim, you just learn a lesson.
Right.
It makes you better.
Yes. and failure can become the pillar to success.
When it is driving, I have to share the story. I was driving 4 years ago with one of my friends. He is 10 years older than me. I take the change the line without putting light. And he said, what are you doing? You cannot do that. I said, I am safe. And he said, no, you are not the only one driving. All these drivers are driving. They need to know what you're doing. And that's a very important lesson.
Thank your friend for me.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. We are all driving in here. So what are you doing is other impact for the other people who are driving there too.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, in the system of the Eightfold System of Yoga, there's this idea of yam, that one has to live a clean life so that you're not affecting others. For instance, if you're a liar, you can't do yoga because your mind will always be disturbed. And if you do things that violate other people, the reaction will always be there in your mind. So it's one of the first stages is become nonviolent in the way that you live. It means don't do things that are disturbing to other people. Very good.
The meaning of the term mantra that we explained, that delivers the mind.
Yeah, how mantra delivers the mind, yeah. Mantra. So one has to try it for oneself. So now we have just like 7 minutes left. Let's go to 9.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we could try a little mantra meditation if you like, and I'll teach you a couple of mantras that I've learned over time. So one of them is very simple. It's only one syllable. It's have you heard Om? So we'll do the Om mantra. So first of all, sit up straight, which is one of the yogic techniques, because as soon as you sit up straight, then your mental system says, oh, we're going to do something important. Just like if you go to an interview and you sit up straight, the person thinks, oh, they really are listening here. So we'll try the syllable Om, which is mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita by Krishna. He says, I am Omkar. So we'll do it 3 times. So take a deep breath, close your eyes, and I'll say, and please just try to emulate. Oh. Samhita as having emanated from the flute of Sri Krishna, coming from the spiritual world, entering this world. And then after Brahma heard that mantra, then he, the Om is almost like a zip file. And when you click on it, then it opens up, and many other mantras you'll find within it. And one of the other mantras is called the Maha Mantra. So this Maha Mantra has three words. Hare, say Hare.
Hare.
Krishna.
Krishna. Krishna.
And Rama.
Rama.
And so it's a 32 syllable mantra. So it's a little more complicated than Om. Should we try it?
Yes.
Okay. I'll say first and then you can repeat. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Krishna Krishna.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Hare Rama.
Rama Rama.
Rama Rama.
Hare Hare.
Hare Hare.
Okay, so now we'll say it together, and I'm going to teach you, because we have enough time, 5 minutes, a method for doing your mantra meditation on your own. Please hold up your right ear and place your thumb on this little segment between that is between your ring finger, and say one.
One.
Now put your thumb on the bottom segment of your ring finger. Say two.
Two.
Now put your thumb on the bottom of your segment of your little finger. Say three.
Three.
Now put your thumb on the middle segment of your little finger. Say four.
Four.
Now put your thumb on the top segment of your little finger. Say five.
Five.
Now the top of your ring finger. Say six.
Six.
Top of your middle finger. Say seven.
Seven.
Top of your index finger. Say eight.
Eight.
A middle of your index finger. Say nine.
Nine.
Bottom of your index finger. Say ten.
Ten.
Now we'll do it together. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. It's a good way to keep track of things, but especially mantras, because when you're walking around and you have a free hand, you can use this hand. And then if you want to do more, you can count the multiples of 10 over on this hand. And so say if you're waiting in line somewhere or whatever, it's easier when you're doing this tactile thing and keeping track of the mantra, okay? So let's try 10 mantras. Does anybody have it written somewhere? A card, perhaps? Just in case someone doesn't know the full mantra. Do you have? You do. You should win some kind of prize for that. I need one.
Thank you.
It's here. Thank you very much. You may need glasses to see it, though. You know the mantra, right? Here, give her one. You can have mine. I think I can remember it. Okay, let's try. And we'll say it in unison, and we'll do 10 mantras, okay? Are you ready?
Yes.
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.
Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
So this is a mantra that you can take home with you, and you can practice this mantra meditation. And I recommend that you take some time every day to just be with the mantra and be present for the mantra. Let the mantra, the sound vibration, go into your ears. And thank you very much for coming all the way to Mountain View to attend this gathering that we had tonight. And I hope and pray that any of the thoughts that I passed down from the Bhagavad Gita may bless your life in wonderful ways. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Natari Armarman, 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 Natari Armarman.